is a previously broadcast program.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
Today, I'm excited to be joined by Jules Gleason, one of the co-editors and a contributor to the new book, Transgender Marxism, published by Pluto Press in May of this year, 2021, along with another contributor to the book, Michelle O'Brien. Jules Joanne Gleason is a writer, comedian, and historian. She has published essays in outlets including Viewpoint Magazine, Invert Journal, and Vice, and performed internationally at a wide range of communist and queer cultural events. M.E. O'Brien writes at the intersection of communist theory, trans liberation, LGBTQ social movement studies, and feminism. Michelle is a co-editor of Pinko, and her writing has appeared in Social Movement Studies, Work, Employment in Society, Commune, Homintern, Endnotes, and Invert. Transgender Marxism was published in May 2021 by Pluto Press. It's a book that brings together transgender studies and Marxist theory, exploring trans lives and movements and surviving as trans under capitalism. In the end, the claim of the book is that for trans liberation, capitalism must be abolished. In this interview, we talk about the collective material process of transition, trans visibility, assimilation, and liberation, the history of gay liberation and trans movements, being trans in the workplace, care work and family abolition, and trans solidarities against capitalism and the state. I want to just first ask you to introduce yourself with your name, pronouns, any affiliation that you would like the listeners to know about.
Hi, so I am Jules Gleason, and I am one of the co-editors of Transgender Marxism, this new collection we're here to chat about. My pronouns are she, and I am, I suppose, only very loosely affiliated to things at the moment. Well, I'm very happy to be joining you today.
Hello, my name is Michelle O'Brien, and I am a contributor to the volume, a chapter on trans work and experiences of trans people in employment, both formal and informal. And I also, the chapter I wrote draws heavily from the New York City Trans Oral History Project that I worked with for some years. I write communist theory, teach queer studies at Gallatin, and work as a psychoanalyst, and my pronouns are she and her.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I'm really excited. This book was like, I did a deep reading of it, and it really helped me think through my own positionality in the world. So I'm excited to kind of dive into a lot of the ideas in there. So starting off right away, one thing that keeps coming up in the book throughout different contributors' pieces is the question of how transness might be useful for capital. And this is like being posed after this quote unquote transgender tipping point where there's more visibility, specifically I think for trans women, and more understanding of transness, I guess, in mainstream worlds, although that might be questionable. So I'm just wondering if, like, just to start the discussion, what you think are relative or limited or positive gains made by trans people as a result of this increase in visibility?
Yeah, I'm happy to begin that. So for those of you listening at home who are not familiar with it, the transgender tipping point was a phase around, I suppose, 2014 to 2015, most notably this famous Times cover of Laverne Cox, the star of Orange is the New Black, appearing on Time. And the transgender tipping point is kind of pretty loosely this moment when suddenly there was an increase, like a surge of popular familiarity, let's say, with transgender culture and transgender experiences. And after which, well, to me, the most obvious difference is like after which trans people seem to become a lot more numerous, which is measurable in everything from people applying to become patients of gender identity clinics to transgender specific communities seeming to swell in size. And there's all kinds of ways we can talk about the measurement of it. But clearly at this point, somewhere around, yeah, we could say 2013 to 2015, things transformed pretty rapidly and seemingly permanently towards what had been a cluster of different subcultural circles becoming something more like a mass culture. Well, that's my own reading. Yeah, I think for both myself and Michelle, this wasn't kind of like our point of departure into transgender circles or transgender discussions. However, like clearly the kind of like the transgender question, I suppose, transformed thereafter. And the work of this collection is very much sort of following on in the wake of that and sort of in the confusion that follows and is continuing to follow on from that.
So I'll say a bit. In the far queer and trans left in New York City, there's a pretty well-developed critique of the trans tipping point that centers around a number of points. One is this discrepancy between popular media attention on things, on trans people, and the actual material conditions, social service infrastructure, material well-being, violence against trans people. And so there's certainly a disjunction between the two, and where there might be a lot of progress made in a symbolic popular media realm that only occasionally corresponds to any material progress made in the lives of working class people. And even when we're talking about sort of material progress, I think there's been a lot of good thinking around how, for example, anti-discrimination legislation that we recently won in New York City a few years ago doesn't actually protect people very effectively against being highly marginalized in the employment market because of the dynamics of at-will employment and the sort of broader forces of oppression and racism in society. And so, you know, we can kind of recognize the limits of sort of both liberal equality and liberal celebration, liberal recognition. And I think people are very right to point out and to call attention to the trans liberation, trans well-being, trans life has to be something more than getting on magazine covers and having famous people mention the existence of trans people. I will also say that I think that it's the increased visibility has had dramatic and substantial benefits. And one of the stark ones Jules mentioned is the increase in the numbers of trans people, that part of the dynamics of trans life is at any given time, there are probably a lot of people out there who have internally and privately a trans experience that they are not yet able to act on in the world, to come out, to transition, to find other trans people, to talk about their experience. And I certainly in my work as an analyst, I certainly encounter a lot of people in this situation, and the level of increased visibility just has traumatic implications of enabling a lot more people to find each other and to build life together in ways that I think are very powerful. And then the other is I think there actually has been a dramatic and substantial increase in trans organizing and trans movement building that's happened concurrently and that has taken Black trans leadership and communities very seriously in some ways. I think the Black Lives Matter movement is one of the most substantially trans-inclusive political struggles I've ever seen, more inclusive than I would say than most LGBT rights organizations and organizing. And I think that Black Lives Matter has been very, very powerful in moving money, attention, and support to Black trans-led movements, and helped out a lot in gaining political ground in a variety of ways, whether that means money or specific policy reforms or much broader level of attention and infrastructure, which obviously we have quite a long ways to go, but we're out in the streets and in struggle together, and that the tipping point has been a sort of dimension of this political process unfolding that has dangers, that has backlash, that has what, in the words of one anthology, a trap door, but also has some really quite powerful opportunities and advances.
Yeah, thanks for mapping out. Well, first, that historical moment that we're like in the wake of, and then the kind of the complexities of visibility, how that can bring good things in and also cause some harm. But I also think it's really important, as you noted, to talk about the like kind of Black trans leadership or we see in movements, that's a different kind of visibility than the media or like, you know, like TV show kind of visibility that the tipping point refers to. Now the book, there was one thing that Jules, you and your co-editor Al O'Rourke write in the introduction, if trans life can't be eradicated, it can be normalized and disciplined. So I'm sort of interested in this like
I don't know if you have more to say about this kind of double-edged sword, where there are these gains, but there's also maybe a risk of what we saw with like gay liberation becoming, a movement for marriage equality. I was wondering what either or both of you had to say about this as a potential moment of capture or by capital, by the state. Can we be distracted in ways by like the sort of the way that like transness can be stylized and then normalized and then sold back to us? Or where is there also, I guess, hope for that, the resistance to that capture?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about this bit of the introduction. Yeah, sadly, Elle couldn't join us today. But this was the introduction of something we co-wrote together. And I suppose just to say one more word on Black Lives Matter, there's kind of like what the introduction is trying to capture is that once we have these remarkable and like unpredictable breakthroughs that sometimes are quite hard to keep track of. And last summer, when Black Lives Matter was in full swing, was definitely one of these cases. So this is kind of one of the moments we touch upon, the sort of cleaning of the house moment that brought around the Black Trans Lives Matter rally in Brooklyn. And this is kind of like the optimistic aspect of it, is that there's all of these insurgent kind of intersectional connections, which are just sort of being put into motion rather than just kind of like theorized. I think like Michelle was saying, like we're just kind of getting out onto the streets some of the time. But the other aspect is kind of like there needs to also be a realistic assessment of what's standing in our way. And sort of what you're flagging up here is this section where we talk about the family, about private households. And this is, I think, still an intractable and still like probably where, I don't know if it's the majority of the harm that trans people encounter, but definitely like any group of trans people you meet, if you talk to them about their relationships with their parents, extended families, even the friendship circles they've grown up with, yeah, I think maybe a minority will have had fortunate or blessed experiences, you know what I mean? So this is sort of like this passage, which you're sort of flagging up, that like the repression and disciplining, and I suppose to sort of what, to draw back to what Michelle was just saying, this kind of like privatization of transgender experiences, where many people are allowed to sort of furtively and secretly live out the lives they want to live. But then among the people maybe who raised them, the people who they grew up around, they have to then don another face, don another attire. I think that's something which there's no reason to believe that is going to transform anytime soon. And that's kind of like, well, maybe like Michelle would want to say some more about it. But so specifically, what we're trying to do in this introduction is address this family, address like private life as part of political life, right? Which is a familiar concern for anyone, especially anyone who's read feminist history. But we use a particular framework drawn from Angela Mitropoulos, who's got this, what she writes about it is like economia, so like the binding and normative rules that appear in these private households. And that's kind of like one way which we're trying to approach this broader question, which is then returned to in many different ways throughout the rest of the collection. This question of how can it be that exactly what's supposed to be apolitical or depolitical, or like the safe haven from political and capitalism, the household, our upbringings, our private lives, how can it be that those places are sort of what any trans politics has to work through before it even exists, right? Before we can even like take to the streets like openly most of the time. So yeah, that's kind of like, that's what this introduction is trying to get at, but I'm sure Michelle has some stuff to say as well.
The introduction Jules referenced sort of substantively engages this question of the family. And you had another question, Scott, around thinking about family and family abolition. And family abolition, I think, is a very powerful way of trying to think through these pieces alongside each other, both sort of thinking about the overall circuits of labor markets and capitalist society that the family plays a really integral role in, and then thinking about how nested within that, the kind of violence and tyranny and brutality that trans people face within so many structures of family. And part of the dynamics of the privacy of the family is that it's very difficult to make inroads in there. Like that there's that people are able to constitute a level of family that, or a form of family that's protected against a certain kind of outside scrutiny, a certain kind of attention, a certain space of political struggle. And that a lot of our political movements are kind of oriented to the state, perhaps oriented to employers, perhaps oriented to civil society, and it becomes much more difficult to think in political terms about what it takes to transform families. And like the some of the dynamics of the workplace or some of the dynamics of the state. I think this is a real limit for contemporary social movements, that we are sort of trying to figure out how to politicize and transform these spaces that are, that have deep structural dynamics in the reproduction of collective life. And it's part, I think, of what leads a lot of trans people to sort of be interested in science fiction, to be interested in kind of revolutionary politics in a more dramatic sense, to be interested in thinking about what could it mean to actually come up against and move beyond these limits.
The experience of being trans within this sort of bourgeois ideal of a white family that is still upheld, even though it kind of contradicts the reality of what people are experiencing. Actually, there's one way that you put it in the introduction, talking about how families serve a purpose of a kind of, let me pull it up, I had the quote. You talk about how the family serves not only in this like moral sense that is the way that is often talked about, but also in an economic sense as the project of neoliberal debt imperialism that's like kind of allowing the state to continue to kind of throw people to dispensable situations and somehow maintain itself while doing less and less. So I guess my question is about how this historical point we're in, where there's like more and more trans people, there's still this relic of the family, but the family is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. How does like transness come in as a way to like disrupt that? How can we use that? Use our like the increased visibility, the increased struggle, trans struggle, to continue to work against that, like that kind of stranglehold of the family, not simply morally, but also economically, politically.
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. And in terms of like us addressing the bourgeois family, obviously, like, yeah, the abolition of the bourgeois family is kind of something which is not specific to radical trans theory or anything like that. It also appears in the Communist Manifesto, obviously, and this was something which, yeah, various figures in the First International were committed to and published about in their writing in various ways. So, like, but kind of what's being talked about at this point is the bourgeois family, as in this type of household which brings up the new generation, but also like transfers wealth and assets and fixed capital from one generation to the next, right? So when like the introduction is talking about the contemporary phase, well, yeah, very much what we're drawing from is this extensive like decades of work now that's been done looking at the new right, where clearly the political framework the new right had envisioned was not only about the strong state, but also about strong families. And this is still very much like evident today. Like if you tune into Tucker Carlson, he's not only talking about how like the police need to be given powers to put down Black Lives Matter. He's also, last time I tuned in, he's also complaining about how, you know, today your kid's probably a stoner because weed is legal. So your kid's got bloodshot eyes over the dinner table and stuff like that. This is still like part of the right wing imaginary, kind of part of the right wing horizon, is that families need to be strengthened up and there needs to be more authority against generations and fewer disruptions there. One of the things you said there is like, obviously, Marx didn't really talk about white families. And this is something which, I suppose this is something which more kind of came onto the abolitionist horizon from work like Hortense Spillers. So Hortense Spillers' Black Feminist Critique, which is kind of identifying how, especially in the American context, or specifically in the American context, what's being transferred across generations for Black families through much of US history is not wealth and not fixed assets, but exactly legal dispossession. So like unpersonhood, being unpersoned and so on, across is exactly what's being transferred from one generation to the next. So yeah, I think I've run out of things to say at this point, but that's the reason I suppose that this is, that family abolitionist politics has been of relevance to me and several other people in the collection, is exactly because there is this moment where I feel like a lot of the existing left has sort of strayed from the First International in ways which I think are a shame, and ways which we can sort of reunite with these questions of gender and household oppression quite easily. So yeah, that's kind of my own project anyway.
I'm writing a book on family abolition for Pluto at the moment. I'm sort of in it full swing, as Jules knows and other people knows. And so I have just an enormous amount to say about all of this, and I don't want to take up our podcast time talking about it too much at length, but a few points. One is Jules referenced in the introduction, referenced the family as a site of privatized social reproduction. And I think that it's very helpful to think about the family, not just in terms of a sort of normative ideal that's imposed through policy, that's aspired to by people, a sort of ideological form that exists on the right and as well in culturally conservative sections of the left, but also the family just concretely. Who do you live with? Who do you share whatever limited resources you have available? If you're not able to work, who are you dependent on that you actually know? Who do you cook for? Who cooks for you? Like, these questions of really concrete social reproduction that can be done entirely in the market to some extent, could hypothetically be done in various historical times and for specific strata through a kind of welfare structure or a state structure, but overwhelmingly are done through forming relationships of care, dependency, coercion, intimacy with specific people in our lives. And that the vast majority of children are raised in this kind of structure, that people have these privatized households. And that there's all sorts of political implications for that. And one of those political implications is that it's a total growing up as a queer or trans youth, as a gender nonconforming child. If you are unlucky enough to end up in an extremely unsupportive household, things are bad. And there's very few opportunities for collective intervention in how to change that, that it's insulated from a certain kind of struggle and a certain kind of collective transformation, which is a tremendous problem for liberatory movements and how we think about them. In terms of race and white supremacy, Jules mentioned Horton Spillers. I've been very inspired by the work of Tiffany Lethabo-Kinn, who sort of rereads Horton Spillers and Afro-pessimism and thinking about race and gender in terms of family abolitionism. And I think there's a way of reading that the history, both the history of enslavement and the history of the pathologization of Black families in the United States, in terms of an imposition of a kind of white norm that like demonizes and pathologizes certain kinds of kinship structures, coupled to an actual apparatus of state violence, of economic violence, of historically slavery, really fragmenting kin relationships. And that there's a dynamic, a dialectic in the history of anti-racist, anti-capitalist struggle in the United States between really seeing a kind of white bourgeois family norm as something to aspire to and pursue versus like thinking we could do something very different and very better. Like what would it mean to actually care for each other? And that there's a wonderful long legacy of people trying to form chosen families, trying to depend on extended families, trying to depend on neighborhood and community, and that these both are sort of inspiring and to be celebrated and to be defended, but also run into all these contradictions that have to do with what it means to try to constitute a household in a capitalist society, and uneven access to work, the uneven access to resources, the uneven access to public space, and the way this structures power dynamics internally. And we can kind of point to the bourgeois white family as like an extreme or particularly horrific example of that, or the Christian fundamentalist family. But that even in kind of chosen family structures, the broader dynamics of trying to survive and reproduce ourselves in a capitalist society are going to torque those relationships, distort those relationships, and make it very difficult to figure out how to treat each other well. That there's any time we are dependent on people, there's an element, a dynamic of coercion that becomes a part of that, that we have to sort through, and we have to sort it through politically and collectively in a way that the family as a structure ends up foreclosing.
Thanks for that. And I'm also very excited to read the work on family abolition, because I'm also super interested in that. Maybe we can talk about that when it comes out. But yeah, going back to Spillers, I guess, just both of you mentioned that, like, you know, at the end of Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, Spillers says that the violent experience of women in chattel slavery made into sort of ungendered, right, is how she ends up talking about it, is also, she points to it as a place for rethinking a kind of resistant understanding, like, and reframing a feminism from that experience. So it's like, it's maybe this is what you were referring to, is the kind of dialectic of like changing the impact of the state and economic violence that creates the situation of oppression into a place where you can start framing liberation. And I see that also, that that gets paralleled in, you know, in the 60s, 70s gay liberation movement and feminism too, as like ways that like the places that are excluded and marginalized are places also to like to form a kind of like resistance. And I wonder to what extent you think that trans experience within these structures is also actually like the threat to the social order that the right wing would like claim it to be. I guess this could get back into that question of capture, because it could also be like, you know, domesticated in a way. But yeah, I don't know if you have thoughts on that, like how trans experience like could be liberatory in that way.
I'm most attentive to the substantial intersection between trans life and poverty. This is, you know, particularly true of trans people from working class and poor backgrounds. It's particularly true of trans people of color. It's particularly true of trans women, that their employment discrimination is quite widespread and quite prevalent. And one of the things I tried to do in my piece is think about how coming out as trans, how transitioning, if you're not able to be very stealth and very closeted and very lucky in pulling that off, and for lots of trans people, sort of being stealth is not a realistic goal, that's going to have a huge impact on your employment trajectory, a huge impact on how you're able to reproduce your class position, a huge impact on your economic chances, and that's true across the board. So you see a sort of downward shift in class position for lots and lots of trans people. And then there's a huge host of trans people from poor and working class backgrounds for whom that shift pushes you entirely out of formal employment. That getting access to formal wage labor is extremely difficult. And so you see lots and lots of trans people, trans women, particularly working class trans women and trans women of color, but it's actually quite a widespread experience for trans women to spend extended periods of time engaging in sex work of various sorts, engaging in criminalized economies and hustles. And then you see these sort of little pockets of employment niches where trans people are able to reproduce themselves with some visibility. And that sort of most closely tied to the world of sex work and criminalized economies, I'd put HIV services. A lot of ex-sex workers or current sex workers end up doing HIV prevention services and trans social services, sort of tied up with the world of HIV services. So you have all these weird dynamics around fundraising and public health administration and biopolitical surveillance and criminalization tied up with this sort of nonprofit nexus that people might use as a way of exiting out of sex work into like a lower risk, but also much lower paying job, often with some stability. And in the Trans Oral History Project, I interviewed several sort of former sex workers working in HIV services now, and the kind of dynamic of that trajectory. But you have a few other pockets, and those are growing. I'm certainly attentive to social work. There's a presence of trans women in tech. There's sort of, as changes open up, these spaces of employment expand. But that the, by and large, the experience of trans life is one of significant economic precarity, and that has, so long as that's true, and there's a lot of reason to think it could be mostly true for a long time to come, that has dramatic impact on people's politics, that being highly economically marginalized in a situation of a disappearing welfare state, of hostility and lack of support from your families of origin, of, you know, very little safety net, puts you in a position where you are relying on friends, you're relying on your sort of own ability to engage in criminalized hustles, and makes it very clear that the world is a kind of nightmare that needs to be overcome and needs to be destroyed. And that's not a universal response by any means, but the experience of economic precarity helps me make sense of why so many trans people end up in political struggles, end up in organizing, end up with anti-capitalist politics of a wide variety, and helps me make sense of what, under what hypothetical future conditions are trans people likely to be on the left or to be far left, and that the circumstances of our sort of political inclusion, obviously a strata of trans people could be politically included quite quickly, but really depends on the question of employment and economic stability.
Yeah, so there's a few different chapters of the book to deal with this question of work, I suppose, as you'd expect from a Marxist collection, or hopefully. And yeah, I feel like Michelle and Kate Dale Griffiths's piece both kind of like, yeah, there's the addressing this question of like how trans people manage to like exist as workers, but it's always like, I think as Michelle was alluding to, it's also like any understanding of trans work has to understand the experience of kind of being out of work, long-term unemployment, relying on state resources or perhaps kind of family and friend networks and so on. So there's also like, I'd say also Zoe Bilinski's essay, which is called Transgender and Disabled Bodies Between Pain and the Imaginary. And in another way, kind of Anya Flowers' essay, The Class Struggle of Proletarian Trans Women, which is kind of looking at this more through, I suppose, like this, that essay is more using this framework of like direct market mediation and indirect, kind of in terms of like the reproductive labor. So there's like a bunch of different perspectives kind of addressing this, this question of both what it means to like exist and make it in a workplace as a trans person, and also the very commonplace reality that a lot of the time that's not really like where we end up. Where we end up is more your industrial reserve army of labor, your sort of proletarians insofar as you're stripped from the means of production, but not proletarians insofar as you actually have a source of exploited toil which you're like reliably committed to. So yeah, I like Michelle, I definitely consider like us spending so much time in the underbelly of capital and of its reproduction is definitely like a huge part of why it's such a commonplace to find communist trans people or whatever, like leftist, anti-capitalist, whatever you want to call it.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
1-2-1-2, tune in for another episode of Marooncast. Marooncast is a down-to-earth black radical podcast for the people. Our hosts, hip-hop anarchist Simile the RBG and sex educator and crochet artist KLC, share their reflections on maroons, rebellions, womanism, life, culture, community, trap liberation, and everyday ratchetness. They deliver fresh commentary with the queer, trans, gender non-conforming, fierce, funny, Southern girls, anti-imperialist, anti-oppression approach. Polyad and bullshit. Check out episodes of Marooncast on Channel Zero Network, Buzzsprout, SoundCloud, Google, Apple, and Spotify. All power to the people, all pleasure to the people. Peace.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Scott. You're hearing my conversation with Michelle O'Brien, a contributor, and Jules Gleason, contributor and co-editor of Transgender Marxism, published in May of 2021 by Pluto Press.
Or even anarchist trans people, which is the sort of enclave I inhabit. But yeah, I like the sort of narrative that you put out, Michelle, puts a kind of poses a way that a trans person could become politicized in a particular way. One of the things that the book in multiple essays like kind of grapples with is the extent of trying to survive under these conditions in a way that's at least somewhat like bearable versus having even the energy or the ability to fight the conditions that create that form of, you know, deathly oppression. And like, I think a lot of the essays do a really good job of like trying to talk about how we can create situations to survive and then also think about where we can fight against them. And a lot of the work, one of the most important things for me reading this whole book and reading everyone's piece is how it sort of intervenes within the discussion of social reproduction and like thinking about trans life through care work. So I kind of want to, it's something we keep kind of mentioning, but I wanted to dive more directly into that. So maybe if either of you wanted to talk a little bit about how you think this the transgender Marxism reframes social reproduction, like, because there's a feminist version of that, and I think that you're building on that in here, but doing something different with the specific trans experience, and specifically also talking about, like, transition through this lens. Yeah, maybe we can just start with just sort of understanding what a trans analysis of social reproduction might be.
Yeah, that's an exciting question, because social reproduction comes up in this collection in a bunch of different ways. Let me think. Yeah, so, well, like, social reproduction kind of appears on several different registers across the course of this collection. The first one is in the very first essay by Noah Zizanos, which is called Social Reproduction and Social Cognition, kind of like brings that Marxist feminist framework into dialogue with some more sort of mainstream psych kind of approaches to how people develop their identities from a very young age. I guess the different approaches taken in this collection kind of speak to the pretty broad set of approaches that Marxist feminism has increasingly come to deploy. And it's worth mentioning that this is also, like, social reproduction is not actually a framework which every Marxist theorist or even every Marxist feminist is really committed to. So it's not exclusively an SRT collection. However, I suppose that I first came to this framework, to the framework of social reproduction that is, like, focusing on workforces, like, come to be workforces in the first place, like how people come to be laborers and sustain themselves as laborers. The point at which I came to this, I suppose, was exactly in the wake, as I was saying before, of the tipping point, and kind of like in, I suppose, as part of my frustration that so few people really were providing any explanation as to why this was happening. And that was something I actually found to be very prevalent on the right. So right-wing accounts of these things would just depict it as some kind of mysterious degeneration, or perhaps an ideological mania. But I also was finding that a lot of, like, social theorists didn't really seem to provide any satisfying or even like helpful attempts at kind of working out what was going on. So social reproduction was something which I personally kind of, like, was, like, pretty committed to around, like, 2016. And I would say, like, that a lot of the collection is kind of taking that sort of, like, meaning of the term and that kind of avenue of inquiry, which is specifically looking at communities and subcultures, if you will. But I would rather say, like, these kind of reproductive circles, like, in whatever form they take, which provide people collectively with the kind of means of making themselves transgender. Which, as we've discussed, primarily means, like, surviving as a transgender proletarian, although that's not the only variation, as we all know. So, yeah, so that's kind of, like, the primary meaning which I've been interested and invested in. But as I say, this isn't like a settled question, and this is kind of like an ongoing discussion within Marxist feminist theory as to, like, the best terms to use and the best kind of, like, frameworks and understandings. So, yeah, I'm happy to say a lot more about that. I think probably both myself and Michelle could talk all day about this one, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would distinguish sort of three registers that I think of social reproduction as having a really huge impact on trans life, and I think Jules to some extent referenced each of these. One is thinking about the mutual aid networks, the communities of support, the communities of, that when somebody thinks they might be trans or gender questioning or knows with confidence they're trans, they might go out and seek connections with other people to be able to help them think through both their gender identity, a way of thinking about themselves, the concrete steps around transition. And this is, I think, partially why we've seen just a giant increase in the numbers of trans people coming out, with a steadily increasing access to the internet, that people on the internet are able to find these communities, and why there have been particular sort of pockets of trans people for many, many generations who are demographically numerous in highly specific social settings. Like, when I came out as trans in 2000, shortly after getting out of college, I looked around. I was in a kind of queer punk scene where there were a lot of trans masculine people and very few trans feminine people. And I looked around the country and I found, like, three or four other punk trans feminine trans women. And then I moved to Philadelphia and met, like, 300 black trans women my age, who were, like, the first trans women my age I ever met. And it's because they had this highly developed scene around balls and houses where they really figured out how to enable each other's transitions that, like, certainly wasn't available in my women's studies department, right? Like, in like, my much more privileged background on some level, but really lacking this kind of supportive space and community. And I, you know, had various internet-based communities to try to figure out how to do this that have since really flourished and are much, much bigger. So that's one meaning of social reproduction. Another meaning is the kind of violence and tyranny that we might experience in our homes, the dynamics of our family of origin, the household as this private space of reproduction. And so social reproduction has been really key to thinking about anti-trans violence. And then another register of social reproduction is that depending on how you parse it, many people identify various formal wage labor sectors as being really integral to social reproduction. So nurses, teachers, daycare workers, elder care attendants, you know, sort of like all these different people that sort of reproducing humans capable of participating in the labor market and participating in society. And I think for various reasons, you see a lot of gender nonconforming people in these sectors. These are feminized sectors. They are sectors that historically have had lots of women and queer people of various genders. I think there's different kinds of historical dynamics that have brought a fair number of trans people into working in these realms, and that these are realms of intense labor struggle currently, and that some of the dynamics of deindustrialization and the shift to a late service economy, that these are not sectors that are easily automated, that the sort of labor, the need for labor is easily reduced. So you really have a growing section in the global north of people working in these kind of labor sectors, and that these labor sectors have a lot of potential for uniting and connecting different sectors, strata of the working class, and bringing people together in different and complex and rich ways as part of their struggle for working conditions.
Thank you. You go ahead.
Oh, just one more thing quickly on the connection. I really appreciated that three-part breakdown from Michelle. I suppose one more thing in the collection, one way it appears is like there's this primarily historical essay by Nat Raha, which looks at exactly the kind of movement struggles which brought what we now call social reproduction theory kind of into being. And she looks at one of these kind of lesser known groups, a British collective called Wages Due Lesbians, which was sort of a counterpart of the much better known Wages for Housework. Yeah, and that was kind of like operating in the context of like the British New Right. And that kind of looks at like some kind of overlaps that she perceives between this group and the much better known Starhouse Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries in New York City. So that's like another approach which you can find in the collection. But yeah, as I say, like there's a at once kind of like a range of different social reproduction theory type outlooks, and also people who don't see that. Well, people who see social reproduction theory are saying to talk about in other terms. Anyway.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Scott. You're hearing my conversation with Michelle O'Brien, a contributor, and Jules Gleason, contributor and co-editor of Transgender Marxism, published in May of 2021 by Pluto Press.
Yeah, no, that was all really helpful to kind of think about what a transgender Marxist perspective on social reproduction could look like in different ways. And the last point that you made, Michelle, was talking about another place, like another possible place for politicization, given that trans people and non-binary people or gender non-conforming people would be working in specific situations for a kind of potential radicalization. That was interesting to me as another reframing of that kind of inherently liberatory perspective that like sometimes gets thrown around and to me seems often like very liberal feeling, like just being trans in itself is like somehow resistance. But you sort of discuss more explicitly how that actually works, right? Through the kind of work that trans people do in the care work that they do for other people. I guess like one thing I might do to like ask to follow up. So like in the, you know, the visibility in the mainstream, the idea of transition then often becomes individualized, right? Like there's a particular internal experience that needs to be like brought out through transition. It often in the like liberal well-meaning perspective will get like brought into the nuclear family that's somehow unchanged by the fact of a transgender child, like that, when there's the focus on a supportive family, right? But the thing that the book really brought out to me that was like, I mean, in a way, it made something way more explicit to me that I personally experienced through transition, is how much of this is done through community. And as you said, Michelle, like mutual aid, right? And we see that also in the pandemic, just with like hormones, like when there's a short, like supply chain break, people sharing hormones, for example. So I wonder if you wanted to talk more about that actual work of transition, because that's something that gets brought up a lot in this book. And I thought it was also a major contribution by a lot of the writers in here to think about the process of transition this way, rather than like the transgender individual who is somehow exists. I could ask more detailed questions, but if you have something to jump in right there, I'll leave it, open it to you.
This is something that other contributors and other people have thought a lot more about. I said a little bit about it in sort of thinking about mutual aid support, but I don't have a lot more to add.
Okay. Well, in my essay, I guess this is this is one of the ones which tried to address this question. I suppose what my own contribution to the book, my essay in this collection, kind of tries to address. It's just called How Do Gender Transitions Happen? And yeah, I think that simultaneously, like, you can't do away with either the personal narrative, the personal like process, the very self-directed, individualized labor, which people go through, or like the community working. But I think it's interesting that these things sort of like, somehow they appear to be at odds, or they appear as distinct to each other. And yet from another view, they always unfold at the same time, right? Like you're always drawing from collective resources, or at other times, like I think as Michelle was saying, there's a lot of kind of parallel development. There's a lot of different communities which are kind of attempting the much the same thing, much the same process of transition in very different contexts and with very different styles. The point which the essay, I guess, is trying to address is how people will tend to sort of switch between these different kind of registers of approaching transition, either as something which is like a set of encounters and something which is continuously happening as you kind of try and negotiate your way through the world, or through the kind of like community rewriting and like re-narrativizing, and yeah, just the kind of specific stuff which actual circles of transgender people can do together.
So going to one of the questions that I wrote, and if this is just sticking with it and you don't have more to say, that's fine, but there's a passage in your introduction that really stuck out to me, that transition must come to be understood by revolutionaries as a response to its own form of hunger, the longings that drive so many to reforge lives for ourselves that leave us thoroughly proletarianized or cast out, rendered surplus. And I like this statement because I think it like leaves behind the kind of gender as a social construction versus essential gender as not even something worth like spending a lot of time on at this point, and focuses on the act of transition as politicized, political, and I think it gets articulated also as ethical. But one thing that came up for me reading this is like, how do we, yeah, I mean, I guess there's this like personal political divide. I could see this being dismissed as a kind of lifestyleism or self-chosen marginalization, like subcultures often get dismissed, like anarchists or punks. And I wonder if you could talk about the way, the thing that I really want to pull out of here is the trans desire. And also like how that position of surplus in capitalism in the state, which is like historically needed for capitalism to function the way it does, but how that we can rethink that place as a site of insurrection.
Yeah, I'll just briefly say that I think desire is really an underappreciated category in liberation movements and the far left. The desire is both sort of far beyond the question of individual choice or individual preference or sort of how we think about sort of market options, that I think in some transphobic conservative left discourse, there's this idea of like people choosing genders in a free way, like a neoliberal subject chooses consumer items. And that I think is a profound trivialization of how deep, how powerful, how transformative, and how uncertain desire is. That desire is very much sort of what sets us in motion in unfolding processes of personal and collective transformation, desire for survival, desire for dignity, desire for recognition, and that these desires are not, they're not trivial sins. They're sins that, like, are not easily satisfied. They're sins that set us on trajectories that we don't know where we're going to end up, and that bring us into alignment and into connection with each other. And that that's just a kind of whole realm, a whole dimension of political struggle that I think trans people, precisely because often most trans people have made a set of personal decisions around changing their gender that were significantly at odds with major sections of our social world, our families, our jobs, whatever that is, and had some clarity that that kind of, that we had a certain, one could say, truth that we were sort of trying to think through or trying to grapple with that might not be an essential gender or a kind of inner gender, but a certain kind of desire in the world, and that that opens up some space for thinking about how the desire functions in terms of the entire working class, in terms of the struggle for the abolition of class society, in terms of the desire to destroy and remake the world. And that there's, that that's just, we need to spend a lot of time listening to that and thinking much harder about that and thinking beyond these categories of sort of like individual choice versus sort of structural determinants.
So I suppose we talked about desire and like the talking about things in terms of hunger. I suppose, so this is like a part of the introduction where we're sort of talking about Georges Bataille, the French theorist, pornographic writer, very heterodox political economist, call him what you will. And Bataille exactly kind of like counterposes this like effort of previous anti-imperialists prior to Marx, who were trying to kind of like elevate things and talk in terms of eagles and surpassing things. This is a critique of surrealism, by the way, so it's a very eccentric essay, but his point is that Marx is more about the old mole, it's more about the subterranean, and this kind of like, and specifically he talks about like the hunger of the proletarian bellies being central to what Marx was trying to do, or like the indispensable feature of that. And I think this is kind of what I feel is like, I sort of feel like the stuff you're alluding to, exactly this, like people kind of dismissing this stuff as like questions of lifestyle or marginalization or whatever. This is something which I feel kind of needs to be addressed, but also it's like, the point is that like, even if they're rarely spoken about in the political field, like transitions are the consequence of cravings, breakdowns, like powerful emotions that make themselves kind of like essential and central to the decisions we make and to the things we depart on. So you use the word ethical, and that's exactly right. Like it's a transition is always going to be about reshaping your life, taking steps, and in some way sort of engaging in activities which like transform who you are, how you're perceived, how you're apprehended, how you apprehend yourself. So I think any kind of approach to trying to do, well, whatever kind of trans theory that doesn't kind of include that is bound to failure. But also, I don't necessarily see this as something we have to choose between, you know, like we know that people seem to be living lives which are filled with kind of like desperation and breakdowns, and then they get hold of these basic, these endocrinological interventions, like they get hold of sex hormones, and this transforms their lives substantially. Maybe doesn't solve all their problems, of course, well, it never does, but it transforms the course of their life. But that doesn't mean we're not allowed to do political economy of sex hormones. I've actually been trying to look something up, but I can't find it. Was it you, Michelle, who wrote this piece on the trajectory of sex hormones that's going across the world? Because I remember I was reading this in one of these trans studies readers collections, but this would be an essay from a long time ago, but I can't remember if it was you or if I was just reading this alongside.
In 2004, I wrote an essay about capitalism and pharmaceutical companies and hormones that then got reproduced many years later in the second Routledge transgender studies reader. So
right, it was
a very
it was
long
the second
time ago.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tracing this body is its name.
Mm. Yeah, and a lot of it's kind of talking about the shipping process and the way that these things like move across continents. Yeah, and I think that is 2004, right? So like people have been working on this for a long time. So this is exactly kind of what I mean. But like, there's no reason to say like, yeah, there's no reason that we can't look at these things in a way which sort of applies an internationalist framework, which looks at how the actual ways that like pharmaceutical companies interact with transition, not the kind of like conspiracy theory version where for some reason pharmaceutical companies are trying to profit off incredibly cheap, low cost medical treatments. But you know what I mean? Like there's no reason that we have to say like, oh, well, there are all of these passionate sensations and there's then this political economy and we have to look at one or the other. But like, it's exactly Marx's kind of materialism that we don't accept that as a choice, right? And it's like, these are things which are continuously interacting. Like people are always trying to sort out their own lives on a very basic level, but then they run into this stuff. Then they run into the reality of having a landlord and having a doctor and all of these other kind of like lopsided social relations, which they have to work through. So that's what the point about hunger is, because as you say, I think this is like a difficult argument to win, but also I think it's like the most important one in a way.
Yeah, thanks both of you, though, like real beautiful answers. And I mean, what you just said, Jules, brings up for me also like, not like there's the experience of the relationship of a trans person to the medical and pharmaceutical industry. Also, like I'm like trans and also chronically ill, and you'll get like leftists who will make this kind of argument that like your existence for either of these reasons could not like persist post-revolution, whatever vision of a revolution they have, because in some way you are so reliant on this like these capital systems of production and shipping and etc. And that, I don't know, that's an interesting dynamic to see the ways that those kinds of genocidal ideas come play out within a leftist circle. I don't know if you have more to say about that. And maybe, Michelle, that's something that you were talking about in that earlier text.
Thankfully, there are a lot of people thinking about this and speaking on it. I wrote a piece for Commune magazine called Chunky Communism. And I, in some ways, wrote it. You wouldn't be able to tell this reading the essay. It's a discussion of the young lords and their work in a syringe, doing syringe exchange work and a detox in the South Bronx during the occupation at Lincoln Hospital, and sort of how that helped shape harm reduction today. And I wrote that essay as, in my head, as a direct response to a really vicious and a very ableist genocidal framework that I saw amongst Tikkunis and some other anarchist streams in the United States of like, after the revolution, all these disabled people are going to die. And like that gets referenced one way or another. I think it's an Intro to Civil War that they say that diabetics are objectively counter-revolutionary. And I think that's a current in the American far left or in the international far left that really has to be directly combated. And there are various ways that we can challenge that and various ways we can critique it. And the one that I go to is a kind of form of radical communist humanism on some level that like a fundamental political principle has to be taking each other's lives seriously and taking the profound preciousness of lives that are treated as disposable. And that part of our political task of communists is, or as revolutionaries, is to really cultivate an ethic of caring for each other, of defending each other's lives, of treating the subtitle in the piece I wrote on Commune is no one is disposable. They're really not participating in the kind of ranking of the value of life. And the trans, that obviously comes pretty directly out of my experience as a trans person and thinking about sort of trans life as treated as disposable on all these different social registers in the world.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Gunnis.
McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., And finally, a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawen Odas Sedalio Fazio. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Avec Nathalie Di Palma. Sur les ondes de CKUT, le 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir. Notre invitée, Lousnak, est une artiste multidisciplinaire d'origine arménienne, née à Beyrouth. Alors qu'elle a 11 ans, elle fuit avec sa famille la guerre qui sévit au Liban pour Londres, puis Paris, avant de venir s'installer à Montréal. Déjà à 17 ans, elle commence sa carrière de graphiste qui l'a conduit à signer la pochette des albums de Lassa de Sela et d'Yves Desrosiers, pour lesquels elle gagne en 2003 le prix Félix au Gala de la Disque pour meilleure pochette de l'année. Ensuite, Lousnak développe ses talents de peintre-sculpteur tout en poursuivant des cours d'art visuel à l'UQAM. Elle fait de nombreuses expositions à Montréal, à New York et en France. Également, elle collabore à plusieurs projets aux côtés d'Armand Vaillancourt et co-signe à Paris une exposition de photographie avec Atom Egoyan. Lousnak est aussi actrice, entre autres dans le film d'Atom Egoyan, Ararat, gagnant de 5 génies, qui lui permet de marcher sur le tapis rouge au Festival de Cannes aux côtés de Charles Aznavour. C'est à travers la musique que Lousnak a pu exprimer l'héritage de ses racines. Auteure, compositrice, interprète, ses chansons sont inspirées de chants traditionnels arméniens. Son premier album, Lousnak, est sorti en 2003. Metteur en scène, productrice, réalisatrice et militante de souvenirs, Lousnak a choisi la mémoire comme engagement humanitaire